This podcast is rooted in a singular dream: to aid our culture's growth by fostering collective education, encouraging open discussion, and most importantly, nurturing and inspiring new generations of my transgender siblings. Here's to a transer future. Bex Leone is a lot like nature. Their gender cycles with the passage of each season. They are justifiably angry about the impact of capitalism. And they are tired of white people-centric approaches to problem solving. Bex is raising their voice and fighting for justice in the face of oppressive systems designed to disempower their communities. As a disability justice advocate, Bex's efforts are focused through the lens of community care, interdependence, and communal abundance making, with the understanding that scarcity is falsely created by state control over our resources. Through their poetry, Bex highlights their experiences as a disabled, gender-cyclical, non-binary Boricua in the often visceral texts of Bible perverses and monster literature, in which they reclaim the ableist trope of monsterhood. I learned a lot from Bex in our time together, and I'm confident that you will too. This episode mentions ableism, codependency, police brutality, environmental racism, and white supremacy. This is Bex Leone on Being the Monster That's Under Your Bed.
Hi there. Today I'm chatting with Bex Leone, who uses they, them, or fey, femme pronouns. Bex, why don't you kick us off by sharing a little bit about yourself?
Hi. Yes, it's so good to be here. Thanks for introducing me. I am Bex Leone. I am a gender cyclical, non-binary Boricua.
So can you, for people that haven't heard the term gender cyclical before, just break that down a little bit?
Yeah, for sure. So gender cyclical is a term I use for myself. It's basically related to being gender fluid. I feel that I am gender fluid, but I also feel that my gender cycles, and so I have different gender feels at different times of the year or at different times of the seasons. I think it's also related to, in my brain, like everything is basically a cycle. It's related to kind of like my spirituality, which is seeing everything as cyclical. So I perceive my gender to be cyclical in that same way, very much related to my spirituality and my like respect for nature and love of water.
Cool. Thanks so much for sharing that. So Bex, you are someone who's been super outspoken about disability justice. So, you know, from just hearing you talk, I hear that disability justice and disability rights are often used interchangeably. And I'd love to hear in your words like, what the distinction is between those two and also why that distinction is important.
Cool. Yeah. So disability justice and disability rights, obviously, they're both disability related, and I think people confuse them often because of that. Disability justice has become kind of a buzzword in a lot of social justice spaces, and I think that it deserves that hype, but I also think that it's important that we know who started it and also where it comes from. Disability justice was a term that was coined by Patty Burns and the Sins Invalid Art Performance Collective. Disability justice is about creating communities of liberation and centering the folks who are most marginalized within, I guess, within and without disability communities, but specifically centering disabled, queer folks of color. And so the disability justice movement has really been interested in creating liberation through building community, through mutual aid, through centering those most impacted and centering their leadership. Disability rights has been a movement that's been around for a while, and different organizations are within the disability rights umbrella. But a lot of disability rights has been very white-centric. It has been kind of like single issue, so seeing disability as always the central and only thing going on in people's lives. And that doesn't match up with the reality of us being people. And it also doesn't match up with the reality of disability. So the fact is that if you are a poor person of color and your city decides to build a bunch of factories or put landfills in your area of town because it doesn't value you as a poor person of color, that then affects your health. Or if you're out on the street protesting and you are brutalized by police for wanting to create a better world and wanting to create liberation, then that can lead to being disabled. And there's all of these ways that society disables us, and it's very interconnected with our other identities as well. And it's also something where if you are a white cishet man and you are disabled, there's still so many other things that make it possible for you to exist within society in a lot of ways that someone with that same disability but a queer person of color would not be able to have. So disability justice recognizes that and recognizes that that is very tied to us being able to create a world of liberation for everyone. So I would definitely say that's the case. And then disability rights is also very much focused on the law. It's very much focused on the legalities of it. It is interested in making sure that people have human rights. And disability justice is, again, it's interested in imagining this new world of liberation and coming into that together in community with each other.
So it sounds like disability justice takes like more of a broader approach to this. A lot of movements that we've seen in the years past center white voices. They center like the least, I guess, marginalized people in the community and leave whole scores of people in the dust. We've seen that with so many movements. I know I've personally seen that with LGBTQ rights, leaving people of color behind, leaving disabled people, leaving neurodivergent people out of that movement. And it sounds like you're also saying like that has happened consistently with disability rights movement, is that they're centering white voices at the expense of other people. Does that sound accurate?
100%. And I'm actually been involved with one organization, a blindness organization, National Federation of the Blind, and they have been very white-centric and very white supremacist in a lot of ways, who they've centered in leadership, how they've continued to not put policies in place that protect marginalized folks. And at this point, actually, they've had this very patriarchal culture, and it's led to a lot of sexual assaults. And the culture has not been about consent at all. And so it's led to all of these things. So again, it's the disability rights movement is kind of, it's very much focused on single issue, and it's had a really a hard time is like a kind way of putting it. Yeah. It's had a very hard time, and I think just not been interested in creating paths of even equal rights for everyone, certainly if we're getting into equity, and certainly if we're trying to think of like liberation, it hasn't been interested in that as a whole. And I would say there have been, within the disability rights movement, there have been times or pockets where this has come up and has been, folks have tried to deal with it, but just as a whole, disability rights has been really single issue in a way that's been very white supremacist, very patriarchal, very much pushed queer folks out. I would say has been legally focused and not focused on creating liberation.
So if you're comfortable talking about it, like what is it like then to be a trans disabled Boricua person in an environment that is operating that way.
So specifically with this organization, I'll just keep on talking about this organization specifically.
Yeah.
Although please. I think that it is something that I've experienced throughout different disability organizations for sure. I don't feel comfortable being in that space because I am not welcome as an entire person in that space. They've made it clear on multiple occasions that they are interested in blindness issues and blindness issues only. And that means that when my blindness issue is also an issue related to another one of my disabilities, they're not interested in hearing that. For example, like in training centers, they always tell folks for like blindness related non-visual training, like never sit down in the front of the bus. That just increases people's like pity for you and it shows that you're not an independent person. But for me, as someone who has like a lot of chronic pain, that was something that was never talked about as far as like, yeah, it's actually fine to like sit in the front of the bus and it's actually fine to allow people to stand up and let you sit down. And of course it's complicated. Of course there is going to be ableism. And that doesn't, honestly, that doesn't necessarily change even if you pretend to be like the most independent person ever. So I think it's that, but I think it's also for me coming into these spaces as someone who is also trans, as someone who is Boricua, as someone who grew up and continues to be poor, I think that I have this very different idea of community and like what mutual aid and interdependence should look like. And a lot of these spaces don't create space for other forms of community. And I think that is something that is very white community tends to be very much about independence and individualism because they want everyone who can't succeed to feel like it's their fault. And I think that I've never been interested in that kind of community, or at least I grow much more and I grow more and more less interested. I grow less and less interested.
You know, both of those words.
I almost said much more and more less interested, so it was getting there. But
hey, I'm here for it.
There was a lot of words.
If that makes sense to you, that makes sense to everyone. Like, just go for it.
I don't think that's how it works, but I grow less and less.
Just let it happen.
Interested. In living in that sort of false reality for me, like I'm not interested in that at all. And so I think that's something that also, it's just uncomfortable because of my perspective on the world, which is related to being a Boricua and is related to being trans and having, in order to survive, built these like really deep and lovely communities, and seeing that not at all present and seeing that looked down upon very much like pushes me out of those spaces.
Well, it almost sounds to me like their idea of the quote unquote best way to exist as a disabled person is to conform in order to make non-disabled people less aware of your existence and thus sort of like erase a part of yourself for their comfort.
Yeah, so it's supposed to be something where you are supposed to be equally as independent as non-disabled people. And here's the thing. I don't want to let non-disabled folks off the hook because a lot of this is very much wrapped up in ableism. But there's this illusion of independence that non-disabled folks live under, this idea that they are independent and they don't depend on others because the world has been created with door handles at a certain place and like all of these different things that's just in our society to make them so that they don't have to have accommodations for literally walking out the door.
Yeah.
Or anything like that. So I would definitely say what's happening then is in a lot of, specifically, I think in a lot of disability rights organizations, but in a lot of disability organizations, what's happening is then there is this push towards you need to be independent like non-disabled folks are independent or need to be seen as that. Mm-hmm. And non-disabled folks are living in an illusion of this. They've literally had society created for them to be like this.
Yeah.
And I think it's unhealthy for them to be living in that. And I certainly don't want to to, again, conform to be able to be seen as falsely independent like they see themselves as. So not that I don't think that there are so many accommodations and different ways of creating access that we can do for ourselves and do for each other, but I don't think that coming into this illusion of independence is the key.
Yeah, well, and so then I'm curious then to hear about what interdependence looks like for you, especially as someone who's involved in a lot of community care, especially as someone who's involved with a lot of mutual aid organizations here in Chicago. Like, what does that look like for you?
For sure. And I recently talked about mutual aid. I know you were present when I was talking about mutual aid with the Black Abolitionist Network and talking about mutual aid as abolition and talking about disability justice in relation to that. I think something that was really difficult for me when starting to talk about it or even just plan this, the workshop that I did, was I was looking up like mutual aid and disability justice and like looking up to see if anyone had like put together extensive theorizing on it that I could pull quotes from or something. And I'm sure that's out there, but a lot of what I found was just these examples of mutual aid happening in a disability justice way, or like these very practical ways that disability justice and mutual aid are connected through like just examples. So for me, it's sometimes difficult to talk about mutual aid or interdependence or disability justice as a day-to-day thing, because it is my, like, so much of my day-to-day. It is a lot of how I, like, exist and have continued to, like, exist and form community. So yeah, I would say interdependence for me is this idea that we all do depend on each other. And I've talked about this before, but I know when I first came on this idea of interdependence, I felt very uncomfortable because I thought I grew up very codependent with my family. My family was very enmeshed. We all had to always be present with each other all the time. It was very unhealthy. And I was like, oh God, I'm not interested in that. And I had kind of been trying to be independent, quote unquote, to avoid this codependency issue. And so I think coming into interdependence, I had to realize that it's not about being continually dependent on one person and only having one person who can ever help you out or anything like that, but it's about creating these community networks of care that say we all do depend on each other to survive, and we all do depend on each other in order to create community and liberation. And so it's important that we care for each other in the ways that we can. And that can look like so many different things. I have a friend who she and I have talked about a lot about community care and interdependence and what she coined as communal abundance making. So really this idea that together we can create abundance instead of this like scarcity model that's always out there that's making us depend on the state. But if we come together, we can create abundance with and for each other on a lot of levels, emotionally, physically, all of that. And of course, that is still impacted by like false scarcity, which is created by the state and by those in power to oppress people. But I think that we can still like come together, and whether that means someone needs like something financial, but then someone else needs some help with just like cooking food or just needs to be like walked through like an anxiety attack or whatever that is. Like there's so many different ways that we can care for each other and really create abundance outside of state control. I do want to say that, like, I'm not saying that there can't ever be scarcity. I think there is, but it's very falsely created by folks like billionaires, folks who are hoarding resources, state control of resources, all of that can happen. And sometimes abundance making means pushing back against that and liberating those resources from the state or from corporations or whatever that is. So I do just want to put that out there as well, because I think some of the time mutual aid, like, as a perfect dream in a perfect society, we would always have everything we needed if we shared our resources. And I think even in a very broken society, we can get very, like, much closer to that than we are if we use mutual aid. But it's not a perfect thing. And I do want to put the onus on the state and people who are hoarding resources for why that's not happening.
Cheers, queers. We'll get back to the show in just a moment. Before we do, I have a really important favor to ask you. I record this production with limited resources, right here in the closet. Literally. So every little bit of support goes a long way towards getting this work out to more people who may benefit from it. I want to take a second to share a few ways that you can help do that. Trans and Caffeinated is now on Patreon, where you can pledge monthly donations. Patron donations are a really important way that this show stays alive, and you'll also get some cool patron perks. If you can't financially contribute, there are still plenty of equally helpful ways that you can help out. You can take a moment to give Trans and Caffeinated a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. You can head to Trans and Caffeinated on Instagram and Facebook and share episode graphics to your story. Or maybe you know somebody who would also enjoy the show and you want to recommend it to them directly. The stories I'm able to share on this show are super important to me. And if they're important to you too, it would be incredible if you could take a moment right now before you go on with the show to complete one of these steps. Thank you sincerely for everything that you do. And now back to the show.
And that sounds very much like a sort of like a mutual aid tenet. Is even right in the Black Abolitionist Network principles of unity, right? Like, we believe in abundance. We don't believe in the state-created concept of scarcity where the wealthiest people in our society hoard resources. We believe that the resources are there and we can accomplish sharing those through mutual aid, through community care. And I'm curious for you, you know, coming from what you refer to as like a codependent family, how has community care been healing or helpful for you since finding this?
Ooh, so community care and how it's been healing for me. Wow. Yeah. What a deep question. I think some of it may be just like seeing myself as worthy of care is like really incredibly powerful. Coming from a codependent family where it was about being enmeshed and it was all of us were not supposed to be autonomous, not supposed to have our own body minds and be individuals in that sense. Coming into community care where it is about creating space for each person to have their own body mind, to have their own presence, to have their own space, I think is really wild. And so I definitely want to say that that has, I think, been one of the most healing things. And just seeing how when we care for each other, we can create the space for all of us to have the different needs that we have and to have those shift over time and to create access for each other in very like personalized and kind ways.
That was beautiful. deep question and a deep response. And I kind of want to circle back a bit here to like this idea of being there with members of your community and this idea of like self-parenting that you talk about as a trans person and how that shows up in your relationship with yourself and with members of your community.
Yeah, definitely. I think so much of being a trans person and being within the trans community, there is so much parenting. There's been so much loss of parental figures, of elders in the community, whether it's trans folks who didn't survive because of the AIDS epidemic or because of ongoing oppression and brutality, or whether it's been rejection from our own biological families or families that we grew up with because of being trans and the rejection in that way. And I think a lot of this does mean that we end up parenting each other. And some of the time it's not even like age related or anything like that. Like, we just kind of all parent each other and we all have to parent ourselves in so many ways as well. In addition, I definitely think like trans folks, we just end up parenting ourselves. Like, I've talked a lot with my therapist and also my friends about the fact that as trans folks, a lot of our experiences with parenting for many trans folks, again, I'm not saying that every single parent has been terrible to their trans child, it's just a very common narrative right now. So I would say that a lot of trans folks experience coming into themselves and realizing who they are and having to assure themselves that that's okay. And doing that parenting job of like holding themselves as they come into this identity and as they embrace who they are. And that has really, that should be like the job of a parent, but a lot of our parents weren't there to do that. And then in addition to that, having to go back and explain often to your parents why you need to be treated differently, why it's not okay that they've been trans antagonistic, why they need to respect your pronouns, whatever it is, like you end up then doing that parenting job, literally representing yourself as a parent to yourself, then representing yourself to your actual parents. And so it's a really fucked up thing that a lot of trans people have to experience on top of then parenting other folks in the community. And on top of, like, for myself, I was a parentified child, so took care of my younger siblings all the time. So yeah, just experienced a lot of parenthood in my life.
So I don't remember how much I've shared with you about, you know, my experience, but like I didn't have the chance even to come out to my family. Mm-hmm. I was a student at a therapeutic boarding school where my therapist outed me to my family, and the whole administration basically shared with them that it was a ploy for attention and that I shouldn't be trusted.
Oh my God.
And so I very much relate to everything you're saying, where, you know, like, left that boarding school after graduating and came home having to not only then like convince my parents that I was trans and undo the damage that that therapist did, but then also sort of explain to them like the fact that you bought into this lie of like me doing it for attention and this not being true, like, has now caused me a lot of harm. And so while I was, you know, undoing that damage for myself and coming into my own as a trans person, I was also then like undoing the damage that had been done to my parents. And it led to me, you know, not talking to my father for a year because I just couldn't have that relationship while he was going through that process. Yeah. And like, it was tremendously painful. So I relate to you know, a lot of what you're saying in that way.
Yeah. Wow, that's so much, and also just like so exhausting. Like,
yeah,
because what should have happened, what should have happened is that at the point that you decided that you were willing to like talk to your parents about that, and then they took on the parenting role of saying, yeah,
yeah,
you're good and you're enough and you deserve love and you should experience affirmation and acceptance and joy at who you are and how can we help you to do that. And should have had advocates as well, because it sounds like yeah. then you had to be your parents' therapist too.
Yeah.
Because this other therapist fucked up and like, yeah, yeah, that's so much.
Yeah. 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 And I mean, I was 18 at the time. So, I mean, you know, technically an adult, but definitely did not quite feel like one yet.
Mm-hmm.
So I also know that you have written poetry about a lot of your identities, a lot of your experiences with disability, with other, you know, parts of your identity. And I would love if you would be willing to share one of those poems with us today, if you're interested.
Yeah, I would love cool. to share a poem with y'all. All right, so this is a poem that was written for my community, for the folks that I create liberation with. So here we go. Pleiades. All my chosen family are demons, a holy hell of vice. I share wine with troublemakers. I break bread with blasphemers that eat the rich, gluttony, that fuck 12, wrath, that if we don't get it, shut it down, envy, that love is love, lust. That existence is resistance, sloth. That your value is not your productivity, greed. That our bodies are enough, pride. And are we not that pride of deadly sins, prowling like roaring lions waiting to devour? Are we not the seven devils come to replace the one you cast from your home? For we are many, Legion, the excommunicates, and we will turn hell into the new heaven.
Wow. First, thank you for sharing that. That was awesome. And I'd love if you could sort of like break that down a little bit. Like, you know, you said that this, you wrote this for your community. And I know that some of this has references to what you were calling Bible perverses when we were chatting outside of this recording sesh. And I'm curious if you could speak a little bit more to that.
Yeah, for sure. So, yeah, I do call it, I kind of jokingly call them Bible perverses. A lot of my poetry has these references to Christian teachings and to the Bible. I grew up in a cult and learned a lot of these verses, how to learn them, like memorize them, and I definitely had a lot of these teachings very much pushed upon me as a child growing up. So writing this poetry is a way of reclaiming my brain in some way, because these are two things that like are in there and I'm like, oh, especially as a pagan, especially as a brujex, I'm like, I don't need to have this shit in here. But I think this is a way of reclaiming it. And I think I'm really not interested in reclaiming Christianity itself or its teachings in any way. I know that people can do that. And I am not here to say that's wrong or anything like that. But for myself, I'm really not interested in reclaiming Christianity in that sense. This poem actually fits into a genre of disability literature that is known as monster lit. And in monster lit, disabled folks, specifically disabled femme and queer folks, reclaim the idea of being seen as a monster. So I don't know if you've ever watched any films with any disabled folks in them. But there's a lot of them where disabled folks are seen as the monster, or where an evil character is given a disability to make them more off-putting or more monstrous. And so disability literature is really about reclaiming that and saying, yeah, we are the monsters under your bed and you should be terrified because we are going to come for you and you might not survive the night, sort of thing. And so that's like, I've written different pieces that fit in that, but this also I think fits in that, but also has this added level of reclaiming monsterhood within Christianity. So this idea of being a demon, being one of the deadly sins, there's multiple references in here. Prowling like a lion waiting to devour is like a reference specifically to Satan. Being cast out of your home, being a reference to God casting like Lucifer out of heaven, as well as just like breaking bread with blasphemers and aligning with like the deadly sins, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So it's really about like reclaiming all of that for me, because in this way, I'm saying, look at all of these things that you hate. I am all of these things, and yet somehow I am more interested in liberation and beauty and morality and creating a heaven that is full of equity and goodness than you have ever been. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's where this poem comes from in a lot of ways. I've been writing poetry for a while, partly for healing purposes, partly for kind of putting into words, usually very visceral words, like what my communities have experienced and what I've experienced personally. So I have been really interested in publishing that poetry and have started the process to be able to do that. And so I am putting together a prayer book, a poetry book called Prayer Book of the Excommunicate, really full of like these different these different pieces of poetry, some around my individual healing journey, some around collective healing, and I guess my own individual trauma and healing and collective trauma and healing. I think part of this poem is it's about creating a community where we are all accepted. And a lot of times that means creating community where we can feel accepted. And that is like in relationship to the communities that we grew up in that never accepted us. Specifically in this poem, there's a line that says, "Are we not the seven devils come to replace the one you cast from your home?" And it's this idea of coming back to the homes that we were rejected from and taking them over, or the communities that we were rejected from and taking them over, bringing all your trans friends, kicking your parents out, type of thing. It's also related.
That sounds fun.
Right. It's also related to this idea of like, the story about like God kicking Lucifer out of heaven. And it's also related to this parable that talks about like, if you cast one devil out, but don't fill up the space that they took, then they'll bring back, then seven devils will come to replace the one that you cast out. And I think for me, there is this idea that we are all, again, that all of us are devils, and that all of us are here to create a community that accepts us where we are, and to create heaven out of the hell that we've experienced.
Thank you so much for everything you've shared, for being on the show today. Do you have any other words of wisdom, any sort of parting thoughts that you want to share before we part?
Sure. I want to know if I have a bunny, and I think my bunny might be my mom. But like my good mom, not my actual mom, not my biological mom. I just adopted this bunny and they are very mom-like. And I was like, oh, you're the parent here. I understand the dynamic. So speaking of parentification, this bunny is, yeah, I am now their child, apparently. they're only 11 months old and they go around and show me where the wrinkles are in my carpet and nudge at them with their nose until I come and fix them.
Oh my goodness. Also, a little behind the scenes here, in for those listening, in the notes that I wrote before this episode, I just wrote, bunny, rabbit, go hippity hop. With a bunch of question marks.
There was a bunch. I feel like bunnies were definitely supposed to come up in this episode. So
well, we made the joke about like releasing a special edition Pets and Caffeinated, yes. which there may or may not be a comic strip in the works for that.
Yeah, I think also Trans Bunny and Caffeinated, because my bunny is non-binary.
Non-bunnery, if you will.
Oh my god.
I did not create that. There's an artist that says that, so I probably can't even claim that.
I hate everything.
But like also love everything.
What?
But also kind of love everything.
Love it. I very much love it. Oh, wow.
Bunny.
Bunny. Yes. I'm trying to think if there's any other pieces of wisdom that I have at this exact moment in time. And I don't think there are. I thought my bunny might show up and say something, and yeah, but they haven't at this point, so.
Yeah, well, before we started rolling, there was sort of like, I guess it was coming from your phone, but I fully thought that your rabbit was trying to say something.
It may or may not have been my voiceover on my phone. It was almost definitely my bunny talking.
That's what I am still going to assume and share with people, that you have a talking mom bunny.
So please keep an eye out for Pets and Caffeinated and the first episode of Pets and Caffeinated, Trans Bunnies and Caffeinated, which will have an accompanying comic strip about a bunny.
What is your bunny's name?
My bunny's name is Basil.
Basil. Yeah.
With a Z.
With a Z. Amazing. Yeah. Bex, how can people find you online or support you and your work?
Yes. So you can find me on Instagram at onmybex_behavior. And in addition, you can contact me on Venmo.
Plug it. Go for it.
I always tell people when I do like accessibility consulting, or I tell them that they need accessibility consulting, and they say, hey, can you do it for free? And I say, hey, please contact me to continue this conversation on my Venmo. So yes, but my Venmo is just Bex Leon, so it's BexLeon.
Amazing.
Oh, and keep an eye out for my poetry book, Prayer Book of the Excommunicate.
Amazing. And once you once that is a thing, I will happily be sharing it on all of my social media, so people who follow me can find that as well.
Amazing.
That's all for today, folks. Don't forget to subscribe to and review this podcast so you can stay up to date on the latest episodes. If you feel inclined to support this work financially, you can head to patreon.com/transandcaffeinated. You can follow my personal accounts on Twitter and Instagram at Ariel R. Gordon, and you can follow at transandcaffeinated on Instagram and Facebook. Now it's time for credits. We love credits. You can follow the show's editor and opening music composer, Joey, on Twitter at Nora Q. Rosa. You can find her band, Fempathy, on both Facebook and Twitter at Fempathy Band, and on Bandcamp at fempathy.bandcamp.com. You can follow the show's closing music composer, Helena Drajansky, on Instagram at thegayagenda95. You can follow her music on Instagram at Helena Ford Project and on Bandcamp at helenaford.bandcamp.com. You can also find her work featured in the Transformations Marketplace on transandcaffeinated.com. I'll see you in 2 weeks on the next episode of Trans and Caffeinated.